Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the China Programme at the OIS. I'm Michal Maidan, Head of China Research at the Institute, and I'm joined today by my colleagues Anders Hovey and Philip Andrew Speed, both of whom are Senior Research Fellows at the Institute. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Thank you.
We're here today to discuss a paper that Anders and Philip wrote, a paper that was funded and commissioned by the UK Ministry of Defence, that looked to understand China's dominance in rare earths and the policy options available to the West in light of this. So why don't we just jump straight into it with a first question for you, Philip. Why all the fuss about rare earths?
Well, there are 17 rare earth elements, and they're becoming increasingly important for the low carbon energy transition. Their application is particularly important in permanent magnets for wind turbines and electric vehicles, and also in batteries. And particularly strategically, many uses in the military sphere. So that's why, say, the Department of Defense in the US is very interested. The problem, and why everybody's excited, is that today China accounts for about 70% of rare earth ore extraction through mining, and about 90% of processing and refining to produce rare earth metals that go into the applications. China's also the only major supplier of heavy rare earth elements. And so, you know, China basically dominates the rare earth supply chain. And this poses risks to the West, both in the low carbon energy transition and for military purposes, because China at any time could reduce or even cut off the supply of rare earth elements and metals to the West and other countries. And only really in the last year or so have Western nations launched systematic programs to address this vulnerability. But it'll take several years for these to make a substantial impact.
So you've given us some data, very staggering numbers on where China figures in the supply chain. I want to unpack that supply chain a little bit and understand, I guess, the different stages also of rare earth processing and supplies. You say that China dominates the mining of rare earths. Is this because they mainly occur in China?
No, China definitely has large proven reserves, but they are widespread. They occur on many continents, but in very specific geological settings, particularly, at least for the geologist, alkaline igneous rocks, which contain mainly the light rare earth elements, and also in weathered crusts and clays that tend to host the heavy rare earth elements. There are significant reserves, for example, outside China, in Russia, Brazil, India, and also Australia and the USA. And new deposits are being found in Latin America, South Asia, and Africa all the time. The major producers, interestingly, are not where the major reserves are outside China, but are in Australia, in the USA, and also in Southeast Asia. However, you know, the Chinese have been working on this for many years and have managed to keep their costs low and undercut miners in other countries.
Philip, I'll just add to that and say that it's not just the mining that is dominated by China, but also especially the processing and then the final end development of the rare earth minerals into permanent magnets. At this point, China is 90% dominant of the permanent magnet field. So it's got the whole supply chain for rare earths from the mining, processing, and manufacturing.
So if I can go back to Philip, it sounds like there is just as much and even more, a greater dominance, which is more pronounced in processing and refining of the rare ores than in the mining. Philip, talk us through that a little bit, please.
Well, as in many metal supply chains, it is the processing and refining that is a key part of the supply chain. And this often occurs in countries separate from where the ores are mined. So in the case of rare earth metals, after the initial beneficiation of the ore at the mine site, the processing and refining to produce high purity rare earth metals is a very expensive, complex, and multi-stage procedure. And these procedures dominate the capital and operating costs of the supply chain. Operating costs are dependent on availability of cheap energy, the chemical reagents, and the labor, and preferred locations have good transport infrastructure, cheap electricity, close to producers of chemicals, and access to a supply of natural gas. Now, China has led the world in the research and development for processing and refining for decades. And as a result, the rare earth mining companies in countries such as the USA send their beneficiated ores to China for processing. And China has managed to keep this strong position in the processing and refining of rare earth metals.
Numerous components, therefore, then. We've got the energy costs, the labor, the availability of land. Anders, what about the, I guess, the other end of the supply chain, demand? Demand for rare earths, how much of that is concentrated in China?
Well, currently, as Philip mentioned at the outset, rare earths are used in just a huge variety of different devices in different sectors. You have medical MRIs, lasers, computer drives, other electronics. You have industrial magnets and wind turbine permanent magnets. And then finally, you have motors for hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles. And a lot of those fields are dominated by manufacturing in China. Not necessarily completely, but if you look at the permanent magnets, for example, China has 90% of that market. And largely that has developed because of China's dominance of the whole supply chain for rare earths, which are one of the most expensive components, even though that technology originally came from the United States. Now, permanent magnets are used in electric vehicles and in wind, but they're also used in all sorts of military and civilian applications that are important to the economy as a whole. And in terms of the types of rare earths that will be needed in the clean energy field, which could worsen dependence on China. So for example, while neodymium is the biggest rare earth in terms of weight, in terms of the number of tons that are sold in the world market, it's used in a variety of different products, and it's a light rare earth available in many world regions. And in contrast, dysprosium is very rare, very costly, very expensive, and that's really more used in wind and EVs. And so you're going to see potentially much more growth in this field, and therefore there's much more concern about dependence on this relatively rare and relatively expensive rare earth that might only come from China. So it's not just enough to look at the supply and demand of rare earths in general.
Okay, so if we can take that and look forward at the outlook for future demand, both in terms of specific rare earths, demand sectors, you've been looking a lot at innovation and how that impacts the outlook. What can you tell us about, sort of again, what we know of future trends?
There is widespread agreement among various different important bodies like the International Energy Agency, Department of Energy, the European Union, and others, that rare earth demand is going to rise substantially, and that is being driven by these clean energy application EVs and wind. That said, there is huge uncertainty about the scale and speed of that growth, because not only obviously there's uncertainty about EV deployment or the wind build-out speed, but also there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of the rare earth demand for those individual EVs or those individual wind permanent magnets. And that points to how there are actually a lot of different strategies for potentially mitigating the rare earth demand increase that will come about as a result of this clean energy build-out. And those demand reduction strategies have resulted from the market, and in some cases, they might also be helped by conscious policy efforts. I just mentioned three of those strategies or overall ways that we could see more uncertainty about future demand trajectory for rare earths. One is just omitting rare earths and using technology alternatives in wind or in electric vehicles. That generally carries a performance penalty compared to using rare earths. But by segmenting the market, that you often find that there is a middle ground, a performance that can meet the needs of the market and reduce costs potentially as well. That's what happened with the LFP battery, the lithium iron phosphate batteries, which still do offer lower performance, but because there's a segment of market that can handle that, that is viable. And that seems to have happened with rare earth batteries in Renault, Mercedes, and then recently Tesla announced similarly it's looking to eliminate rare earths in its motors. So maybe that's for a certain segment of the market, or maybe it starts to affect the whole EV market. Similarly, you can look at the wind market and see that as wind turbines have gotten larger and more efficient, people had expected that more high-end permanent magnets with more rare earths would be necessary. But in fact, that's not been the case. The wind industry has been able to adapt and use rare earth-free magnets in more turbines than had been expected previously. A second option is to not eliminate, but just reduce the rare earth of permanent magnets. And that appears to be a good option in the wind sector, for example. Again, there's trade-offs in terms of performance, but it's more of a continuum that you can optimize for cost, performance, lifetime, so on. And then third, you can also shift the proportion of different rare earth elements in the permanent magnets. So for example, it might be possible to dramatically reduce the amount of dysprosium. Again, there can be performance and other trade-offs, but it's often worth it.
Sounds like from a Western corporate point of view, there's uncertainty or there's complications around demand, costs, a very intensive process from the mining to the processing, and then a huge uncertainty about the demand outlook, which makes it very difficult to invest in that supply chain. Philip, can I turn to you and ask, how, therefore, has China managed to achieve such dominance? Is it the state capitalism that has enabled or that has offered, I guess, China some foresight or just economic latitude to invest in the supply chain?
Well, I think history counts. The first discovery of rare earth element ores in China was about 100 years ago. The first production started in 1957 in Inner Mongolia in what is now the world's largest rare earth element ore mine. And really, I suppose, since the opening up in the late 70s and 1980s, the government, the central government, and even local governments have systematically supported the whole rare earth element supply chain, particularly initially in the mining and processing, through financial support for research and development and investment through the supply chain, and more recently in the downstream as well as the upstream. And should we say that the scaling up and the cost reduction was due in part to low safety and environmental standards, as well as a large number of illegal operations. And so this allowed costs to be low and therefore undercut producers in other countries of the world. Also, what's very important is that China has the world's only large-scale production of heavy rare earth elements ores, and these are from weathered crust clays in southern China. But coming back to the safety and environmental standards and illegal operations, during the last decade, the government has made huge steps in raising safety and environmental standards and cutting out illegal operations.
I want to come back to that environmental standards for a second. Obviously, the mineral industry has a reputation for causing substantial environmental damage, or more or less, depending on countries and operators. Is this the case also with rare earths? You seem to suggest it is. And I guess, to what extent has this contributed or facilitated China's large role in mining?
Yeah, I mean, mining of rare earths produces huge quantities of solid waste, and some of this is radioactive. And in this mine in Inner Mongolia that I mentioned, the tailings dam has been leaking radioactive thorium and other pollutants. And in the past, because the dam had no lining. Now, they've dealt with that now. The processing stages release, but they lose all sorts of acids for this, so that the plants release acidic gases. These need scrubbers to remove, to stop the acidic gases going into the air. But in the past, many small and medium-scale plants didn't have these scrubbers. And I think worst of all are these heavy rare earth element-rich clays in southern China, which lie at the surface. And the operators have basically used in-situ acid leaching to release the rare earth elements. And not only is this very inefficient with a low recovery rate, but it causes extensive damage to land and water. But as I mentioned, the government has been addressing these problems and appears to have made progress. But historically, this has been, one, a major problem, and two, it's assisted China reaching this dominance through having low costs.
How do we then compare that to, I guess, the West? You say on one hand, China is tightening environmental restrictions and regulations around this, but will the environmental impact inhibit mining and processing in other countries? Is there an ESG element here that will be hard to reconcile? Or actually, as China tightens its regulations, there will be a more level playing field between China and other producers?
I mean, in general, yes, these environmental issues will add costs and time to get approval, costs to address and mitigate the pollution. And it will very much depend on the national and local governments and the societies in the locations. Australia in the outback, it may be quite different from Western Europe, for example. And there are recently discovered rare earth element deposits in Arctic Sweden and in Greenland, for example, both within Europe. And these are already facing strong opposition from local populations. However, there will be locations where the opposition is less strong and the relevant government will be more robust in pushing through projects. So I think, yes, this whole ESG element is very important, but you know how this is managed will vary from country to country. Certainly, if you can imagine mining in developing countries, that might be easier. But my guess is that, say, for example, in Europe, they'll be keen for processing to take place within Europe. So even if there's no mining in Europe, there will certainly should be or maybe processing in Europe.
Anders, I'd like to come to you to follow up on that. Which steps or sort of what are the steps being taken in the West to counter China's dominance?
Well, I'd just like to point out at the beginning that this is not our first bite at the apple. It's our second effort to address the rare earth issue in outside of China. When the initial price disruption and supply disruption happened in 2010 and 2011, there was a rush of activity and a large amount of interest from investors and policymakers, and that was ultimately not sustained. And to me, that does point to how when things are just left to the market, because China can produce rare earths very cheaply. So Molycorp in the United States and the Mountain Pass mine and other similar efforts just couldn't compete against that, not without sustained policy support. And don't want to say that the market is totally ineffective, because some of the demand side aspects that I mentioned earlier, those have come from private industry looking to reduce risk and reduce costs. Now, in the last 3 years, the United States has been very active in doing a number of activities to address rare earths specifically or critical minerals more generally. First one is banning Chinese rare earth use in military applications. Second is investing directly using the Defense Production Act in mining and processing activities in the United States. The U.S. also has looked at stockpiling rare earths. Initially, that got off to a poor start when U.S. Stockpiled raw rare earth ores, and then those would still have to be processed in China. Now, as of this year, the U.S. is actually stockpiling neodymium, praseodymium, and permanent magnet materials. And then most importantly, the Inflation Reduction Act last year contained explicit tax credits for rare earth production and requires that critical material inputs for EV batteries should not come from an entity of concern, or they won't be eligible for the tax credits. And that, of course, is pointing at China. Now, other countries are also active. Australia, I'd say, in some ways, most active in terms of exploring and then opening up new mines. And this is led by Lynas. And then some of that activity has been supported by government loans, for example. And then Japan and Korea, which had been involved in the permanent magnet market, they had sought to diversify away from Chinese rare earth suppliers. And both have worked with Australia, including with Lynas, on expanding supplies from Australia. The EU also has recently gotten into the game, published its Critical Raw Materials Act that includes targets for 2030, and those really specify benchmarks for the amount of rare earth mineral extraction, processing, and recycling that should take place in the European Union. And it sets a 65% threshold for the maximum annual consumption from any stage of production or processing that can come from a single third country. So I think that's clearly, again, pointing at China. And then I think a really important aspect is that countries are starting to cooperate on rare earths. The U.S. most recently led the establishment of this Mineral Security Partnership, and that was essentially aiming to diversify rare earth production away from China and to really use that as a way to accelerate the clean energy transition. That group held its first meeting in September last year. And I'd also mention that the International Energy Agency also has a critical materials initiative and is working on rare earths. So there's a lot going on, but as Philip hinted earlier, it's going to take time to see how effective those measures are. They will take years to pan out. And I think it's our view that by 2030, the Chinese dominance of the rare earth field will still remain in place, even if the diversification has started to take hold and reduce the reliance overall.
That will give us plenty of scope for further analysis and work. And obviously, we come back often to one of our favorite topics, which is the role of the markets and the role of the state and how the two interact and the kind of guidance they need to offer, I guess, the markets. But Philip, I want to turn back to you, I guess, to our exam question, right? What is the outlook for China's dominance in rare earths? And Anders has already talked about this a little bit. But to the extent that it remains, at least until 2030, could it be limited? And if so, under what conditions?
Well, I think I'd just like to reiterate what Anders said, that, you know, 2030 is 7 years away. It takes time, even without ESG concerns, to turn a discovery of ore into a large-scale operating mine. And if you have ESG concerns, that is going to add time. And then, you know, the issue is the processing. I mean, that is the key. And, you know, Australia, there's a processing plant being built and maybe a couple in North America and the USA and Canada. But, you know, that needs to scale up as well. And that will have ESG concerns as well as capital investment concerns. And going back to the role of the market, if it is left purely to the market, many of these projects may just stall as in the past. So what is needed is sustained policy support from governments, both unilateral and multilateral. Otherwise, you know, we're going to be back to where we were 10 years ago, where, you know, the price goes down and then they stop investing and China retains its dominance. So let us assume that some or all of the relevant governments keep pushing at this. It will take time. And so I agree with Anders that China's dominance will diminish only slowly. And particularly, I suppose, from the period 2030 to 2040 is what we're looking at. But again, coming back to Anders' earlier discussion on technologies, this will not just be driven by mining and processing capacity, but by technological change and switching of the amount and types of metals used in these devices.
Anders, maybe a last question for you to go back to political mandate, the geopolitics around this. The talk of reshoring, friendshoring, does it make sense based on what you've researched and seen? And perhaps more importantly, what are the implications for the energy transition?
Yeah, I think I would absolutely reiterate what Philip said about if we didn't have long-term policy consistency to promote diversification of supplies, then as soon as the price goes back down again, then the financial backing for expanding production or diversifying processing away from China, I think, would go away. You know, it's not because the market is stupid, but it's once the price is low for a long period of time, then those efforts cannot be sustained. On the demand side as well, where I mentioned earlier, I think the market has had a larger role to play. Companies won't be as active in looking for alternatives to rare earths and won't be as eager to invest in technologies that would reduce rare earth consumption in these fields that are seeing the largest growth. So I think there is a role for sustained policy just to support research and development in these fields, as well as policy incentives and initiatives for example, new offshore wind turbine bases where clearly policymakers are setting the conditions for those leases. They can include small incentives that don't even have to be monetary incentives for reducing rare earth consumptions. And similarly for electric vehicles as well, making sure that there are some incentives, perhaps not necessarily hugely costly or hugely binary Chinese or not Chinese critical materials. You know, the subsidy goes up or down based on that. It could be a little bit more subtle than that, But I think that having those policy incentives in place lets the market know that there is going to be sustained demand for technology alternatives to high rare earth consumption, which I think is currently the default. So I do think that there's a role for policy. And ultimately, I think that what we've seen in the battery space shows that when we have policy support for a variety of different technologies, then we do see surprises. We do see that the technology that was favored 5 years ago is no longer necessarily the technology that will be the most important going forward. And that, I think, has panned out in the battery space in a way that reduces our risks and increases our resilience. And I think that that will be the net result of these policies on rare earths as well.
So very much plenty to continue to look at, research and understand and unpack, and things that we in the China program will be doing much more work on. Unfortunately for today, that's all the time we have. Philip, Anders, thank you for these insights, for joining us today. The paper is available on the OIS websites, as are links to our other publications and podcasts. To you, our listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you will join us next time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.